Welcome to this week's anime podcast. This week it's just a two-hander again, though not with the usual suspects. I'm here using the Jitsi handle proper T-E-A, is theft. And with me is a good friend, Suzanne. Not James, who's off boking into a bin, which is what he usually does on a Saturday afternoon. For those of you who know what the word boke means, congratulations. It's nice to see you here. Or not see you, hear you here. For those who don't, you can look it up on Urban Dictionary. For those who know the pun I just made about proper tea is theft, will know that this particular podcast is about Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, the father of kind of modern anarchism in many ways. He's the first person to describe himself as an anarchist. And he referred to anarchy as being order, rather than law being order, I suppose. That's our topic today. Not so much his life, we'll briefly touch upon that, but much more about his ideas. And I'm going to say hi to Suzanne. How are you doing, Suzanne? It's a not long time no see, because I've been talking to you for the last hour. But how do you feel about contributing about this bizarre, eccentric French philosopher?
Hi, Alex. No, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm just going to add some more sentences to that in post-production. all about how I'm great. Anyway, we'll get straight into it because no one listening to this podcast wants to hear our stupid banter. Or maybe they do. Well, we'll start another podcast where we just discuss my many failings at the age of 21. So, Proudhon, born in the early 19th century in rural France, goes on to become the father of kind of quote-unquote modern anarchism. What about him and certainly his background kind of created that person? I mean, no, everyone is individual and everyone has their own biological quirks that comes with them from birth, whatever, but there was a lot of nurture in how people turn out. So what about his nurturing, or lack thereof, Suzanne, do you think made him disposed towards this kind of contrarian libertarian viewpoint?
I suppose part of it potentially was, I suppose, some of his upbringing, as you're saying, some of his nurture in the sense, because I think he was the son of a tavern keeper and a cooper. And so I think his family also kept a family farm. And I suspect some of his sense of individuality or independence may have derived from his kind of background of working on the land and potentially kind of, I suppose, creating your own wealth from the land. And I think as well, potentially as well, because I think he went on to become a journeyman, wasn't it, in a printing press. And I suppose, again, he's always kind of worked for his own kind of independence. And I think potentially that may have helped him develop some of his worldview. And I think as well, because his family weren't the wealthiest, I think because when he went to, when he didn't manage to get into, because I think he had no formal education until his teenage years. And then when he did get into the college, I think it was through the help of a bursary, I think of a scholarship, but through kind of a wealthier relative. It's interesting that I think in the actual college, he came into contact with a lot of wealthier families. And I think he did experience some of like ridicule because of his background as well. And I don't know whether that in any way also kind of potentially help him develop this view of kind of how certain segments of society treat others and things like that.
Yep, definitely. That was a part. I mean, he does come from that kind of classical revolutionary artisan background, whether it be what happened in Paris in the 1880s, 1890s onwards, whether it be what had happened in England with the English Revolution of the mid 17th century, or what happened in Ireland with the United Irishmen of the late 18th. Universally, it is this kind of artisan class of skilled workers who have the time to be educated, who have the time to read, have a sense of ownership of what they are creating, and are also being, pardon my French, fucked over by industrialization in the late 18th and into the mid 19th century, that are most politicized and the most radical. I'd say that without equivocation, historically speaking, that's what's happened. So he had lots to kind of provide him with kind of revolutionary credentials, and certainly with the type of personality he had, which was his own. His interaction with wealthy landlords who, for no other reason that their distant ancestors were barbarians and warlords, possessed all this land. And certainly he would have been growing up at a time when memories of the French Revolution were very, very much to the forefront, you know? And also hatred of the Bonapartist regime, which only would have fallen when he was still a child. So there's a lot there going on that creates who he was. But we're not really here to talk about him as a person, as we already said, but much more his ideas. And so we'll start with maybe the most famous of his many ideas, which was, of course, the soundbite, which has been now known across the world as "all property is theft," which is my Jitsi handle was making fun of. His first great work was published in 1840 on this very topic. It is much quoted and much more misunderstood. So, Suzanne, you can maybe describe a combination of those two things. What did you think "all property is theft" meant before you read up on it? And what do you think it means now?
I think it's a very good question what you're asking, because I think if I just read like "all property is theft," and as you're saying, my view of just reading that before having any kind of background reading was kind of a puzzle to, like, surely not, property isn't theft. Like, how can it be? And I just was kind of bewildered by it. And then I think as I read some of the readings that you politely asked me to read in preparation for the podcast, it kind of developed my understanding of what I actually meant. And I think I've a certain grasp of it. I still think there's a lot more of kind of, I find some of how he wrote and some of the things of how other people wrote about him a little bit difficult to always dissect exactly what he meant. And I suspect that's also linked back to how sometimes, as I think we were talking about in another time, about sometimes he wrote in a kind of contradictory way, I suppose, on purpose. But am I understanding what now, because originally when I thought I read "property is theft," I really didn't know what to make of it. I thought it wasn't correct. I wouldn't have agreed with him. After reading what I thought, I suppose what I think he meant by it is kind of this idea that the people, current people in society when he was at the time, and I suppose he would argue people in society now, people who own land, I suppose if you call them capitalists or landlords or the aristocracy, whatever version of that, of the group of people you're talking about, they kind of are owning land in a way that is exploitative. And it's basically they do not, like, it's they own it because of kind of the private property that they own is because they occupy it rather than actually use it. I suppose some of the central argument was that workers should have access to the property because in his sense it was a public good. And so therefore, if you have it kind of cut the, if you had an ownership of land consolidated in a certain group of people who weren't using it, then that in its very essence or nature means that the property is theft. And I think what he was trying to talk about was this idea that he wasn't against private property, but I suppose you can clarify that. I think it was more that he was kind of saying that you can have some form of private property, but it's more about workers having access to the land and it's people and workers in the sense that it's the people who use the land and that everyone should have equal access to it and to enjoy it.
Yeah, essentially that was his point, which was that, he was fundamentally believed in the labor theory of value, which is that however much work you put into something, it creates its value. So if you're creating a shoe and it takes 7 hours to make the shoe, the value should be associated to that 7 hours. And what he meant by kind of property is theft is that that land is a public utility. It belongs to the community, belongs to the people, not to any one individual or family because of the distant relative being a warlord. Pardon me, their distant relative being a warlord, and therefore it should be handed out equally. And ownership should be connected to the labor you put into it. So if you're, say, if you have, I don't know, 30 acres, and you're using 15, and you want to plant houses and rent out the other 15. You're not using that 15. It's you're basically vampirically sucking people's money away who could use that 15. Let's just say you put three families on that 15 acres and each use 5. That should be their land. They're using it. It's a public utility, much in the same way that most of us don't believe we should be paying for water because it's a public fucking resource, or should we, that most people should have a roof over their head because it's insane to let people starve and freeze out in the streets. Again, not everyone in Ireland agrees with that idea, but most, you know, people with a soul do agree with that idea. Then again, it's the same with land. And there is examples of this being put into practice in Spain in the 1930s, in kind of the few examples that existed in Ukraine as well, where communities came together. Usually they took over these vast estates that were owned by the kind of bankrupt morally and often financially aristocracy, and ran them in kind of associations or communes. And the farmers who may have been sitting on, I don't know, 10 to 15 acres who were using those acres were not touched. They were said, you know, you do your own thing. You'll obviously, if you want to trade with us, that's we'll arrange that. But we're not going to be stealing, you know, your property. So it's not so much that property is theft as private property of estate owners, of landlords, is theft. Individual property, personal property, isn't theft. And that's something that people often get wrong, oftentimes intentionally to misinform people as to what anarchists and socialists mean.
No, I think what you're saying is correct. Like, I do think that, and I suppose that's where I kind of, when I read through the what Proudhon was saying, I was actually quite surprised, because my initial understanding of anarchism would have been, or socialism in general, would have been that people are completely against private property, and that's actually not the case. I do think, because I suppose why I was thinking about when you're talking about it was just, and I think you're right, I don't think anyone who has a brain would be against, you know, the ideas of basic access to needs and things like that, and everyone should have a roof over the head, completely agree. But I was going to play devil's advocate for a second and just say, okay, let's assume we allow all workers access to land, right? Or that you have, you know, property rights are derived from use, which I suspect is a summary of what he was saying. The actual practicalities of doing that, and also potentially the inefficiencies of not actually, if you have workers doing it, I suppose my question of, I'm not saying I fully agree in how capitalist society runs every single aspect of what they do, but one thing that it's hard to argue with is that there's a lot of inefficiencies with small land ownership, which is correct. Whereas, and I'm not to say there is examples of where you can have large land ownership, and of course you can envision inefficiencies as well, but I'm curious to see, is there a way around this idea that if, and this was maybe moving on to another part of what Proudhon talks about, but if we're talking about letting people have access to land, I'm curious to see how would that end up in an economic system, or how would it end up allowing for some of the benefits of kind of large land holdings, of like returns to scale and things like that. How would that kind of play out if you did kind of implement some sort of property ownership scheme as what he's kind of talking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's again, the few examples you can turn to historically provide some illumination, but it's such an untested idea, even 170 years after he came up with it first, that I can't provide any definite answers. What happened in Spain was these giant estates, which were owned by the landlords, were taken over by the tenants and by the agricultural laborers who worked on them. Usually what happened, there was about 70% of land in the agricultural land in these areas were taken over by the workers who were from the old landlord class. About 30% or so were already small farmers. Some of them traded and kind of became part of the agricultural system that was created in these areas. Others were like, no, I'm just going to be a subsistence farmer. I don't really want anything to do with you. And they did that. But even them, some of them eventually, by the end of the kind of socialist anarchist period in Spain, were doing business with these kind of large agricultural federations. And so what we'll be talking about maybe next is that idea of kind of federalism and how that would play out. So it's not so much that individuals or individual families are, you know, owning all these little plots of land and not working with each other. Kind of the essential conceit of Proudhon is that people will work with each other. They do have kind of a collective sense of, at the very least, that there's more to be achieved with more resources, but that those resources have to be controlled democratically, and they have to be responsive to the people who put the work and labor in. So it's not so much that, okay, there won't be some type of orbit of authority that comes with, you know, 70% of, or however much of the land in Ireland now, I don't know, I have statistics in front of me, are owned by a very small group of people. But, you know, a large amount of that land, whatever it is, in Proudhon's mind, should be going to the people who are working on it. And again, that's also complicated in the here and now, but because, you know, most Irish farms are heavily mechanized and not a huge amount of people live in them, I'm making the thing more complicated than it needs to be. But the point I'm trying to raise is there's no perfect answer for how these types of things would function, because they've never been tried long enough for them to be, for the kinks to start showing. But what evidence we do have is that there was actually increase in productions in places like Valencia and in Catalonia of agricultural goods when farmers ran them themselves, and when kind of agricultural laborers ran them. And the same with the industrial centers in Barcelona. They actually increased their productions, and beyond that were actually safer and healthier place to work. From even those who are conservative, who have reviewed the Spanish Revolution, have said, you know, what they did in these industrial centers was remarkable. Just didn't have much time to survive. But anyway, the whole point of Proudhon, I think we've kind of touched on his idea of property being a theft, kind of explained the ideas. How exactly you would go about reversing what has gone on over the last 300 odd years and make land more democratic is another story, maybe for another podcast. I would advise anyone listening to look up an event called Land War in Ireland, which goes into how about 97% of the Irish of the land in Ireland was owned by about 10,000 people in the 1880s, and by the 1920s it was about a quarter of a million farmers mostly who owned 97% of the land. But look that up and maybe have a think about that. We may be doing an episode on that one day. Our next kind of topic, I suppose, is a bit about what he proposed to replace landlords and industrialists and kind of in general kind of political class, which is what did he believe should replace this kind of hierarchical capitalist model of society. He believed a mutualist federation of workplaces, of municipalities, basically the disestablishment of the state as we understand it today, he felt should replace it. Do you want to kind of explain a bit? I mean, obviously I'll fill in any details, what he meant by a mutualist federation, and did this kind of change over time?
I mean, I can definitely give you my understanding of what I read, but as you said, I think you can probably give a better summation than what it actually is. So from my reading, what I understand, what I meant by mutualist federation was this idea that, this was the current, I guess, democratic form of government or capitalist form of government should be replaced by, I guess, federations or communes or whatever word you would use, or I guess groups of workers working together through mutual association and like mutual agreement. And I think a main tenet of what he was talking about, or the federal arrangements he was talking about, was this idea that, I suppose, to try and get rid of wage labour, have the means of production in the hands of the workers, and whether that's labour associations and things like that, and that they should be run on kind of, that basically the two parties involved in any sort of exchange should be on equal footing, and that there shouldn't be kind of be an inequality of power. And in particular, that the laborers should have access and kind of control of the kind of industrial exchanges that they engage in. And so I think that's what he meant by the term mutual, in the sense of, I guess, mutual exchange of power. And I think also linked to this whole kind of his idea that I think you can probably explain better is also kind of, I suppose, the idea that if you're agreeing into a mutual exchange, at any point you can also decide to not be part of that. And I guess central to that is this idea of liberty, that and independence, like you can agree to be part of something and then later on disagree to be part of it. And it's that idea that you can kind of turn away from it as well when you want to.
Yep, that's essentially what he was talking about. It's again, because he's the first person to really propose this in any kind of serious depth, because no one really had dreamt up the idea that society or the state or the kingdom or whatever, the hierarchy of society, should be removed and everything should be leveled. I mean, some people had talked about it, but nothing in the same way he had. That workplaces, municipalities, you know, should become associations of workers, cooperatives, communes, whatever you want to call them, in which workers had control. Those who put the effort into society should control society because they should control their own labor. And that together, as you know, a organization would be created which would trade and which would kind of replace the nation state, which had already formed by the time he was a young man. So that's kind of what he's talking about. And we can talk about how feasible that is, but he felt, and again, some examples exist, though not great examples, of these types of associations being put into practice, whether in Spain, whether in Italy, in the kind of the worker count, the industrial councils of Northern Italy and after World War One, in Ukraine, the same thing kind of happened. Agricultural laborers kind of seized the big estates of the nobility and ran them in the same type of democratic fashion. Even some examples in Ireland of that happening during the Irish War of Independence in the 1920 through 1923. There was about 100 creameries that were taken over by their workers and ran democratically. Suzanne, did you know that, Suzanne? Did you? But you probably did. So there's examples that are out there, and even some cases improving production with them. How that would have worked in the long term, whether it would have worked in the long term, whether the tribalism that's innate, or I think is innate to human nature, would have come up is a question for, well, it's actually our next question. But essentially, what would you be your qualms or your thumbs up to those that type of idea?
I mean, to the idea of trying to create a mutualist federation.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with some of his some of the beliefs, if that's it. I don't think it's probably ever going to realistically happen on a macro level, because a lot of the examples you're quoting, I do accept you're right, probably a lot of them weren't. I mean, did I know that a lot of people, was it creameries? People took over, workers took over creameries in Ireland? No, I did not know that, Alex. And how did I not know that? But I think in terms of, like, is it feasible? Like, a lot of the examples you're using are really micro examples. And I think it's, you know, when you have these ideas or of, like, you know, assemblies or of workers or labor associations, I think in micro scale, they work really well. But when you start trying to take them to, if you take them, you don't actually have, that's the first point, I suppose you could say. But if you take them to a bigger level or a bigger, wider area or a wider industry, I don't always know how practical they are, because oftentimes, because one of the main issues with this type of governance, it's not an issue, it's just more of a question, I suppose, is like, as you kind of you touched on it as well, like the tribalism of people. When you have groups of people in discussion trying to agree something, if one of the tenets of his of Proudhon's system is that everyone is independent, it's based on liberty, and of course it's also based on rationality of human beings and reason. But if you have the independence, how are you ever going to reach consensus? If you don't accept some sort of majority rule at some sort of level. And so I like the idea of everyone having a voice. And I like the idea of the hands of power, you know, the power being in workers' hands. I agree with that. It's just more the questioning of how actually, and I know, I suppose, yeah, you're right, the feasibility of it. I just don't know in realistic terms as a work. And also, as we said, and we're going to go on to it in a second, I suppose, would there be a fracturing because of the importance of liberty and choice and independence in Proudhon's teaching? Is it a juxtaposition between what he's talking about in a mutualist federation?
Yeah, I mean, it's a legitimate question, at least in my mind it is, and it was a legitimate question in Proudhon's mind, because by the time he died, he was talking about having some type of administration, and certainly he was very nationalistic to a certain extent by the end of his life. He certainly believed France was, like many 19th century Europeans, was a unique and kind of civilizing force in the world. And he was certainly in favor of slavery when it existed. And he was in favor of women having a certain place in society, and not a good one. So, I mean, he did rather get conservative towards the end of his life. And he did believe that there should be some form of government, even if if it was just an administration, and even if it was a recallable in a way that only really, I think only Switzerland has that type of facility where you can recall the government at any point, as long as you get a certain amount of signatures and support from the general public. But as a general rule, they're not. Governments are fairly independent and can do whatever the hell they like. The political class can as well for the 4 or 5 years they're in power. So yeah, no, it's a legitimate question. What would be, you know, and again, it comes back to an essential point, which I have disagreement with anarchists, which is that it's not a utopian system. It doesn't solve all the problems of the world. It just aims to solve certain problems, which is, how does power manifest itself? How can you control people from becoming too corrupt or too authoritarian? It does that quite well. It doesn't necessarily make things tremendously easy to decide, which is a whole other question. And again, there's no such thing as a perfect system. And I always say to people, if you come into this, these ideas thinking it solves all the world's problems, then you'll be sadly mistaken, and you very well might be so sadly mistaken you take off in another political direction, looking for another type of all-encompassing black and white political system, which in the end will turn out to be a cult. Sorry to disappoint the listeners, that's my experience anyway. But that's kind of what we're talking about, really, is our own beliefs about human nature and about how people behave irrationally. And that's certainly not something he believed in his youth. His central belief was that man possessed rationality or logic and could control his or her emotions, that this would inevitably produce a gradual improvement of society over the centuries. He believed the Enlightenment and even before that, the Protestant kind of Reformation was a sign that society was improving, industrializing, modernizing. And he believed in a form of Enlightenment teleology, basically that, you know, we were all on an upward trend. Is this belief really defensible? And if not, does it undermine his whole fucking argument? Pardon my French.
I think I think in terms of the question of is it defensible, I suppose it's a question mark, isn't it? Because I think it's like a fundamental question that everyone asks. I mean, can humankind be rational? I think yes, in a lot of instances. I think past adolescence, I think majority of people do have a sense of reason and control their emotions, yes. I don't think emotions are always bad things. I think having emotions makes us human. And I think, but I suppose having the ability to reason and make decisions based and being able to reason out your emotions is what's important. Whether or not within his imprudence, actually thinking about it will, like the end point was that we'll just keep improving in terms of reason. I don't necessarily agree with that because I don't think history unfolds, or I don't think human history unfolds along a linear path. I think different sections of the world and different sections of society can go through cyclical versions of being ruled by reason and then being ruled by emotion, or I suppose identity politics or other things that are more emotive rather than rationality. And I think the other interesting thing about what he's talking about is that I think the other question part of that is, do I agree with that part? No. Does it mean that it undermines his whole argument? Maybe. I think if his argument is that mutual federalism and kind of this whole political system or economic system he's talking about can only come about if people are engaging in mutual agreements and associations through use of their reasonable faculties and reasoning and things like that, I think the assumption that everyone is going to be able to engage in it is maybe a bit difficult to conceive and say yes, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to history, which is our kind of how we met to some degree, was our mutual... Oh, that's my dog banging in my computer for no reason. Thank you, Polly. To go back to history, which kind of was our focus when we met, there are examples of trade unions. There's examples of associations throughout history. We don't need to go over some of them. I've already brought up where people could use rationality or logic to say, okay, well, we're going to have to strike, or we're going to support another strike, and in so doing, we'll get better workers' rights, et cetera, et cetera. Or we'll need to, you know, the Chartists or the various people who marched for universal suffrage, the suffragettes, of course. They had a sense that they would put the time in, and in the end, people would eventually see their reason, their logic for these things changing. And I do think you can get people to, you know, go outside of their comfort zone and kind of abandon these kind of gut emotions to get things to change. Because historically, I can point to so many where that has happened. We don't have slavery anymore. That didn't happen because slave owners decided one day that they didn't want to make any more money from slavery. They had to be pressured over decades and decades and decades. Things didn't change quickly. So I think you can use reason and rationality to change people's minds. But sometimes, you know, it's a pendulum. Sometimes it can swing back the other way. I mean, certainly if you told people after, I don't know, like 1950 or whatever, that the type of workers' rights that they brought in across Europe and certainly in Britain were going to disappear within 30 or 40 years, and that society as a whole would be so bitter and so antagonistic towards anyone proposing those ideas across British society and newspapers and TV, I think they probably would be surprised because they thought things were going another direction. So I do think people are composed of irrationality and the ability to think rationally. But I think what might undermine his point is that he believed people, you know, were far more rational or logical or whatever than maybe they are. I think maybe at best we can say it's a balance between one's emotions, one's heart and one's head. Suzanne, what do you think of that?
I agree with you in the sense that it is, I mean, he's a kind of, I suppose, sorry, I think overall in terms of one of my issues with kind of this idea about rationality in general is that I think the historical examples you're pointing to about where rationality did work and there was, you know, people were convinced of people's reason, I agree with you there. And obviously, yes, we don't necessarily have slavery, but my only thing against that is that it's only looking at certain parts of the world that you can kind of say that, because I think the other thing about Proudhon as well is that we need to remember when he was writing. And I think you know more about it than I do, like after the 1848 revolution, and it was the July Revolution, and it was all that kind of context. But this idea that, you know, like, I suppose, is his kind of argument that rationality and control of emotions, it's like, what sort of rationality are you talking about? Because a lot of people would say that their opinions are rational, but you could have two kind of almost rationalities. And so if you look, go to different parts of the world, there are people that sound very reasonable, and it's not necessarily linked to their emotions. It sounds very reasonable what they're saying, but they're saying completely two different things. And so my question in terms of what Pridhan was talking about is, what sort of rationality is he talking about? Is it based in his context and his reality, or is it based on others? Maybe this is a slight different kind of question beyond the scope of the podcast.
No, I think it's a fair question. I think he's referring to a type of a sense of enlightenment, sense of irrationality, that people can absorb information from maybe different sources and sift through it to discover as much as you can, discover objective truth, and through by discovering that, you know, go the right direction, or at least what he felt was the right direction, which was that, again, it comes back to that type of teleology, which is that society is improving in a certain directions towards a kingdom, or rather a republic of heaven, basically. And it's an obvious point to make, but many people have said that, you know, the Enlightenment comes out of the Protestant Reformation, the idea of kind of rejecting the authority of the Pope, that each individual has a relationship with God through the Bible, etc., and that through the Counter-Reformation, how the Catholic Church changes, it kind of creates the European Enlightenment, which was believing that, you know, we could create this idea of heaven, which we've been dreaming of for 1,000 years, whatever, and we can put into practice in the here and now. Society can become perfect. And I think he was a part of that tradition, the same way that Marx is part of that tradition. I don't think I am, and I don't think a lot of people are actually today anymore, because we've seen that, you know, people are very fallible. It's the most obvious example, and it's a horrible example, but the Holocaust. It's hard to look at that and say there's just so many people involved along the way who were not sociopaths. I mean, there's a lot of sociopaths involved as well, but this, too many people were not monsters who went on to have normal lives, who did such, you know, just horrendous things, that it's impossible not to say that their emotions, their fear, which is emotion, of course, repressed that part of them that said this is objectively evil and wrong. And there's a million examples as well. So I think that in many ways it does undermine the whole Enlightenment way of thinking. Whether it undermines his ideas in particular, he's an Enlightenment writer, so it does to some degree. How you then come up with an idea for a society while taking that into account, I don't know. I don't know if there is a perfect solution, or even a semi-perfect solution, or how you deal with people's fears and ignorance, you know?
No, I kind of agree with what you're saying there. I think it's very difficult to kind of come up with the perfect view of society, and I don't know if it, like, what he's talking about. I don't know if it invalidates everything he's saying, but I do think, just, I suppose it's something to keep in mind whenever you're reading any philosopher or anyone really. You just have to think about what point in time they're writing and how applicable it is, and where they're coming from, because I think it's interesting that he talks about like rationality and reason and the Enlightenment itself, but then also during the same period. You know, the Holocaust is a horrific example, but you also have colonial powers doing horrible things overseas in colonial, in different parts, France included, in Algeria and other places. And I think it's interesting that you have writers talking about, you know, this, I suppose if you talk about the Republic of Heaven and things like that, but you can, it's almost like a juxtaposition that you can only have the Republic of Heaven if you're exploiting other people in another part of the world. And I think, it's not I'm saying I disagree with what they're saying, it's just that I think a lot of writers and a lot of people in general just have a very narrow view of the world. And yeah, I think it's just one of those things that it's just important to remember that it's not just about economics, or it's about lots of different sort of, I guess, types of power and types of things that can kind of undermine different kind of developments of our improvements in society. And I think asking the question, is there going to be a gradual improvement in society? Well, maybe of some societies, but if you're talking about the world society in general, I think there's a lot more work to be done to kind of connect a lot of communities together, whether that's via class or across different countries.
I suppose what we might do to start winding it up is, towards the end of his life, and really throughout his life, but in some of his latter works, he kind of crystallized, you know, the broad view that he felt that the working class was the engine of a revolutionary change, which was certainly something Marx believed and others at that time. But he rejected authoritarian socialism. Again, Marx. They had a huge falling out. Marx often had falling out with people. He was not a very easy person to like, as many revolutionaries aren't. They're most revolutionaries. I don't think it's too much of a broad statement to say we're dicks, but maybe you need to be to push forth these types of ideas, you know. But he, in particular, he was terrified of the idea of the kind of the red tyranny, something that Mikhail Bakunin, who was a friend and follower of Proudhon, later kind of wrote about it quite a lot, which is that the state will take over from landlords, from industrialists, and will be a bureaucratic, technocratic tyranny, which would be worse even than what existed before. Do you think he was prophetic in his fears of this kind of communist fetishization of the state? And can you think of some obvious examples?
I suppose my quick answer would be yes, I probably. I think he was probably prophetic. I think in terms of, I think there is a definite fear. I think he's probably was correct in being fearful of what would replace, if you have any sort of power vacuum. It's interesting to see what could kind of step into that vacuum. And I suppose if you're, I'm not professing that I know a lot about Marx's teachings or things like that at all. But I think, yeah, having a fear of it, definitely he was prophetic. And I can't remember your second question, so I'm going to hand it back to you for a second.
I asked if you could think of some obvious examples. Well, the obvious examples one can think of is to be, you know, let's be polite to some of my friends who are Leninists. You know, Stalin, late 20s onwards, what he did to Ukraine, which he very much felt was a peasantry and a bourgeois peasantry resisting collectivization. Millions and millions are starved to death. Which has been described as genocide, the blind kind of sociopathic trials of the members of the party in the show trials of the 1930s, all Mao's Cultural Revolution, his Great Leap Forward, the hundreds of millions of people that died in that, all of it driven by this kind of state cult, which is born, I mean, to some degree, its roots are in just some of the basic ideas that Marx is talking about, the kind of the, you know, and certainly Engels in particular writes about when Marx died, the type of idea of the vanguard of this party of cadre of genius revolutionaries who again are coming out of the same Enlightenment tradition, who believe that they know what's right and that people just need to do what they say and that things logically will work that way. And it's not what happened, because people don't, you know, think that way. We kind of talked about that before, but either way, he's warning about this at a time when no one is warning about it. It's like very early on, you know, when Marx is an actual political refugee in Paris, you know, he's saying to him, you know, if you do this, it'll end up in a authoritarian tyranny. What we need to do is try and come up with a way whereby we can restructure society peacefully and, you know, and democratically as best we can. But, you know, not by putting a small group of people in dictatorship of the proletariat, you know?
No, I agree with what you're actually saying in terms of that. I think he was prophetic, actually. And I think he probably was correct in that warning that he was giving, I suppose, particularly if he was in conversation with Marx. Am I right in thinking that, I think, what was it in response to property's theft or another thing that Marx actually wrote a book in and I think took some of the words of the title of Proudhon's writing. It was almost like, maybe you might remember what the name of it was. I thought it was quite interesting that, like, I think when Marx first met Proudhon, he quite liked him, but then obviously their relationship became more antagonistic, as you're saying. Basically, they had quite opposing views on this.
Yeah, he wrote a pamphlet called The Poverty of Theory, Marx, in response to one of Proudhon's long titled works, which included the theory of something and poverty or whatever. And he said, well, this is the poverty of theory. Basically, Proudhon's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about, which Marx did to a lot of people he didn't get along personally with. To be honest with you, I've met more childish people on the left than I've met. Well, I've met them on the right as well from coming in contact. Basically, anyone with a kind of a black and white view of the world tends to be a bit of a dick, or a child, or both. And so, yeah, no, they didn't get along at all. And that was carried on by anarchists in the present day, who often don't get along very well with what would be called tankies, basically Leninists, Marxist-Leninists and their descendants, and with Trotskyists and Stalinists, etc. So, I mean, it's kind of an easy punch or an easy kind of attack to make there, but it's true that he did see these things coming far earlier than anyone else did. But what we'll do is we'll wrap up one last question, which is a bit of an obvious one to bring up. Proudhon was far from a perfect person. He was a virulent misogynist, racist, and anti-Semite, and fairly nationalist towards in his ideas of France and its civilizing role in the empire. And actually, towards the end of his life, was becoming more and more conservative. Many anarchists are less problematic. I think of Emma Goldman off the top of my head. Is there anything worth learning from him at this point in 2021? Suzanne, did you learn anything from him that you thought, oh, that's good? I wouldn't otherwise have known that or thought that if I hadn't read him.
Yes, I have learned. I definitely have learned something from reading him. But like, I learned something from reading most people. I don't think it's necessarily like. I think my answer to your question is there something worth learning? I think usually there's something worth learning from everyone, even if that you disagree with them, right? Yes, I do think there is something worth learning from him. In particular, maybe his views on property and things like that. I think they're quite interesting. And I like the idea, and I do like, you know, I do think it's interesting that he was, you know, warning against some of the things that may have come across in terms of the communism and things like that as well. And I like the idea that he talks about, I suppose in some senses when he discusses the place of reason in kind of equality and liberty and kind of tying together all these kind of concepts. I think my only kind of question of the issue with him being misogynist, racist and an anti-Semite is that if a lot of his philosophy is talking about, or I suppose his teaching is talking about the importance of reason in allowing for, you know, mutual exchange and things like that, it's interesting that a lot of aspects of his life, he wasn't necessarily a person who practiced it. And so does it invalidate some of his teachings? I think so, yes. I think sometimes, you know, that's probably where I'd end it.
Yeah, certainly if you can't practice what you preach, people should usually avoid you. I mean, that said, I mean, there's a lot of things I've read by Lenin that certainly State and Revolution, which was one of his more libertarian-minded tracks, which I can agree with, while at the same time disagreeing with a lot of the things that he did, you know, disavowing the election, which actually happened in Russia in 1918, what he ordered to be done in Kronstadt, which all of which you don't need to know. Suzanne, it's all very boring kind of inter-left fighting that happened over 100 years ago. But at the same time, I can see value in it while also acknowledging, you know, his problems. I think this is something maybe for another episode, but people's inability to understand that individuals can be almost pure evil while at the same time coming up with the odd good idea. I think the arguments, you kind of have to take it face value and kind of ignore the individual. It's like the old thing, you know, what's that thing about love the sinner, hate the sin. I think you kind of have to, you know, pump both barrels of the metaphorical shotgun into Proudhon for his many problems and his many issues, while at the same time saying his arguments in regards to property are very sound and they're logical in many ways. In my mind, they are. His ideas about mutualism are very interesting and certainly are worth discussing. That does not mean, I think, because of those, my agreement with those two ideas, that I ignore that he said that all Jews should be stripped of citizenship and maybe just wiped out as a race. I mean, that's very hard to forget. And he did say it. And it wasn't something that was clipped out from, you know, a discussion. Maybe they should be, but really they shouldn't be. He had these biases, and it's just, I think if people can look at any character and judge them by, as again, I'm saying the word logic or rationality. We had an episode last week where we discussed, actually, maybe that's not something that's innate, and we've discussed it here. So I don't know. If you are easily, if you're a very tribal person and you're easily follow somebody who you agree with about one thing into another field, maybe don't listen to Proudhon. If you have the ability to sift through things and make your own mind up, he's useful. I think that's probably a fair statement.
Yeah, no, I probably agree. I think definitely. So, I think he's definitely worth reading. And I agree with you there. I think it's one of those things where I think most people are worth reading and worth listening to, and that's the whole point, isn't it? I think some of his views are interesting, and as you said, particularly about property and mutualism, are interesting to think about. And I think it's interesting to have that discussion in modern times versus when he was writing. And so, yeah, I definitely think he's worth a read. But yes, I would also have that warning that you gave as well, because I definitely personally do not agree with so much of what he said.
You'd be hard pressed to find many people that agree with everything he said. Okay, we're going to wrap it up there. Hopefully, those of you who've listened to this enjoyed our take on Proudhon, his ideas anyway. There's many other things to learn about him. And if you go to the bottom of the podcast, you'll find a couple of links for you to follow if you want to learn more about his life and his ideas. But that's going to be us for this week. If you'd like the episode, please do share and subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to this on. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, and I think we're on Tumblr as well. I lose track. But it's goodbye from me. My name has been proper T is Steph, otherwise known as Alex. And say goodbye to Suzanne as well. Goodbye, Suzanne.
Bye, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Say goodbye to the listeners.
Sorry. Bye, listeners.
Bye.